Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ with Lauren Gilger. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. And now it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
Our clients are coming to us sick. They had limited food while they were in there, that they were cold, that they didn't have access to water at certain points or to the bathrooms.
We need to unite as Republicans, and I need others who are independents and Democrats who are open-minded to see me as their senator and what I'm doing to fight for them. I'm independent-minded. I'm supporting and fighting for Arizona.
Your duty is to place rules in place that protect, not pervert, the innocence of our children, our precious, precious children.
And it's important to remember that the Constitution calls for a head count of every person living in the U.S., not every U.S. citizen.
And joining us to talk about President Trump's endorsement of Senator Martha McSally's reelection bid, a testy State Board of Ed meeting, and more are John Gabriel, editor-in-chief of Ricochet.com, and former congressional staffer Roy Herrera. Guys, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
So let's start with Senator McSally winning the complete and total endorsement of President Trump. Roy, we just heard her saying that she needs Republicans, Democrats, and independents to take a look at what she's doing in the Senate. What does the president's endorsement do for her?
Well, certainly it shores her up with the Republican base, which I think is partially the calculation here. I mean, there were news reports that she was potentially facing a primary challenger. This is the similar kind of situation that we had when she ran for Senate last time, when she runs against the risk against running against a very conservative Republican in a primary. She has to, you know, tack to the right in order to win the primary. So I think a lot of what happened here was to make sure she's safe with the right. But, you know, we just heard comments from her looking for votes from independents and Democrats. And I think the closer she gets to Trump, the harder that is for her.
Yeah, John, that was one of the criticisms of her campaign last time, was that she was too close to the president and kind of alienated folks, especially here in Maricopa County, who are maybe more moderate or even Republicans who don't really love the president.
I think heading into an election year, it's important she has that, at least on paper, a tie to Trump, as long as her rhetoric doesn't match it all the way through. Because they'll vote for him for president, but they want a senator that represents Arizona like McCain did, and someone from any party. I think she is just like terrified of a Kelly Ward-type situation coming up again, where in that campaign she was considered an anti-Trump person, and then she radically changed to pro-Trump, and it was just a muddle by the end, and people didn't know what to think of her.
Speaking of John McCain, that's been one of the issues that's been, I think, difficult for McSally to sort of navigate between what the president will say about our late senator and what she has had to say and probably believes about the late senator. So I wonder, how does that continue to play as it seems the president fails to let this go?
Well, I mean, you're right in that the president has continued to be, you know, disrespectful and continue to make clear that he does not like and did not like Senator McCain. And, you know, knowing that he is an icon here in Arizona, it is extremely difficult for Senator McSally to balance that, because I think probably personally, I would guess that she has a great deal of respect for McCain, but then she yet has to go out and support and be at the same events and, you know, be along with President Trump. So that's a very difficult line to kind of walk.
And there's no way to strategize for it. She just has to wake up with a little sweat beads on her forehead, picking up her smartphone, wondering what he tweeted today. That's really the only way you can do it. There's no way to manage that relationship. It's going to be a rocky roller coaster the whole way through. And when she's up for re-election the next time, Trump won't be on the ticket with her. And that the more she ties herself to Trump, it'll be tougher down the road for her.
The word that seems to come to mind for McSally, and to an extent Senator Sinema as well, is tightrope. That they have to sort of walk this very fine line, in Senator McSally's case, between the president and his supporters on one side and other Arizonans whose votes she probably needs to win election in her own right, who either don't like the president or are Democrats or independents who are maybe not sure about the president. How fine, John, is that line that she has to walk?
Oh, it's incredibly fine, and it's always moving as well. Just think of a tightrope in a very windy conditions. But that's what every Republican signed on for when Trump was made their nominee in 2016. It's just, if you want to survive, that's what you have to do and figure out how close you can get to him without getting burned.
Roy, do Democrats try to take advantage? Is there a way to take advantage somehow? Do they try to tie McSally back to Trump and try to hurt her among independents who are not on the conservative side and Republicans who don't like the president?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, that line that she has to walk is increasingly difficult, even more difficult, I think, than last year, because next year Trump's actually on the ticket. He's, you know, above her on the ballot. So, you know, how do you, you know, show that you support him and are going to be voting for him while still trying to appeal to, you know, the suburban households in Chandler and North Phoenix who are turned off by, you know, Trump's rhetoric? Those are the kinds of people I think are going to be considering, you know, an opponent that McSally has, and Mark Kelly, who's, you know, an astronaut, a veteran, you know, someone that people know very well, who's talking about issues like healthcare and the economy. So I think it's going to be very difficult for her to get away from Trump in order to talk about those issues.
So there may be, it sounds like this week, a primary challenge for McSally as well, a businessman no one's really heard of, Daniel McCarthy. What was your reaction when both of you saw this?
I said, who's Daniel McCarthy? That's basically all I had. I don't know what the person represents or if there's any constituency out there. I guess we're going to find out.
Yeah, I've never heard of him before. I mean, I guess the thought that I always have when I hear of a rich individual who's suddenly interested in running for office is that there's a consultant behind that probably telling him that he should be running for
office. Cashing a lot of checks. So
that's my guess here. I've never heard of him before, but presumably if he was going to run, he would try to run from the right, because mm-hmm. I think that's the only way that would work in a Republican primary.
Does it seem as though Senator McSally is vulnerable to a challenge from the right at this point, given what she has done in the Senate and now that she has the endorsement of the president?
I think she will be. There's a certain strain of Republican activists who are just, you're never conservative enough, and the definition of conservative changes to these people on a monthly basis pretty much. So if she had ever disagreed with President Trump about anything in the past, they'd bring that up as she's not a true believer in her cause. So I think she just doesn't want to muddy the waters with a bruising primary contest. She just wants to get right to the general, focus on that, and not only for electoral reasons, just for financial reasons as well.
The thing that struck me, and I had a chance to speak with Senator McSally earlier this week, and, you know, having the obviously having the endorsement of a president is generally better than not having the endorsement of a president, especially when they're in your party. But in Arizona, the president's approval ratings have pretty consistently been below 50% for months and months and months in Arizona, regardless of generally what poll you're looking at. Roy, is there a danger that, like, this could backfire on her in some way?
Well, I think a lot of the answer really depends on how much in play is Arizona at the presidential level next year. I mean, I happen to believe that depending on who the Democratic nominee is, that the Democratic nominee has a real shot of winning Arizona. I mean, Trump only won here by a couple of points in 2016 against Hillary Clinton. If it's a Joe Biden or somebody like that, I think it's going to be very close. And so, you know, the risk that she runs is, well, what if Trump loses here and she's completely tied to him? Either way, it's going to be close. But really, depending on what's happening at the presidential level, really reflects how dangerous it is to be with Trump here in Arizona.
Yeah, John, do you think a presidential endorsement can backfire on her in some way?
It definitely can. And again, if Arizona is a strong battleground state and he's greeting her on the tarmac every other week, that's definitely going to rub some voters the wrong way.
The last question I have about McSally is sort of a little less political, but I wonder, with what she's done in Congress so far, and it, you know, she's been focusing on veterans, she's been focusing on sexual assault in the military, these sorts of issues that I think she's trying to define herself with, how do those play in? I mean, how much of this is just about her record?
I think most people don't dig into the news. They're kind of, a lot of it, what dominates politics, just Trump is standing over it like a, you know, 1,000-pound giant is just crazy. And people are like, are they on his side or against him? And so much goes into that, and people don't get into the details, unfortunately. She's choosing her issues carefully. Interestingly, very similar issues for veterans that Kyrsten Sinema is. I think to her credit, she went back at that campaign and took notes and said, wow, I really got my strategy wrong. I have to do what she's doing. But she can't just mimic Sinema. Sinema has her own personality and style.
Does it seem as though she might be trying to take a page out of the Sinema playbook, though. We heard her refer to herself as independent-minded. She's looking to get Democrats and independents on board. I mean, is this the Sinema playbook that McSally is trying to use here?
Well, she would be smart to be trying to use that playbook, and I think the emphasis there is trying to use that playbook, because at the end of the day, as we mentioned before, she still has to deal with Trump. And to John's point, I mean, you know, politics is driven so much by what Trump tweets and what he says and sort of the outrageous things that he supports, and she constantly has to answer for that. And so, yeah, she can talk about some issues like veterans, stuff that I think a lot of people agree on that are popular here, but at the end of the day, she has to deal with Trump. And then you also add the fact that Washington, the Senate, really isn't getting anything done anyway. So those could be her issues, but it's not like anything's actually getting passed.
There might be a few post offices that have gotten named that's right, in the last year or two. All right, guys, a couple minutes before the break, I want to move on to something that feels like it was an eternity ago, but it was only Monday. There was a very fiery meeting at the State Board of Ed dealing with some proposed changes to language around sex ed classes in public schools in Arizona. We should mention curriculum was not on the table. The state was not going to be telling districts what to do. John, what did you make of the fact that this really turned into quite an angry type of conversation?
I think this type of anger and emotion is going to come anytime there's education. I sat through some of the meetings on Common Core. You know, so no matter the subject, and especially when you're talking about something that has moral and religious implications, especially for certain parents, but this is the result of a state law change, and they need to make amendments. I didn't see anything. They weren't forcing any curriculum, as you say, down the faces of all these districts around Arizona. Everybody would have to make their own decision. So it seems like the real fireworks would have occurred on the local and school district meetings rather than a statewide thing, because the state does not force language on people.
Roy, was this sort of a double whammy? As John said, education discussions tend to be passionate anyway, and then you're dealing with something that for many people is a very sort of personal, private kind of subject matter.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is certainly an inflammatory issue. And, you know, the people, the sort of religious conservatives and those kinds of folks that were upset with some of this stuff were clearly very organized at the meeting. But, you know, to both of your point, I mean, at the end of the day, the curriculum is ultimately done at the local level. And this meeting wasn't about that. And sex education continues to be an optional thing for parents. And so, again, you know, parents can decide whether their kids go to it or not. I viewed the proposed changes as reasonable. I mean, they basically said that you should, you know, have scientifically and medically accurate information in the curriculum. But obviously people disagreed, and it is a hot button issue, no doubt about that.
That is Roy Herrera. Also with us is John Gabriel. I'm Mark Brody with Lauren Gilger in the midst of the Friday Newscap. More in just a minute. Good morning. You're listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 with Lauren Gilger in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. We're joined in studio today on the Friday Newscap by Roy Herrera, former congressional staffer, and John Gabriel, editor-in-chief of Ricochet.com. Guys, before the break, we were talking about Monday's Board of Ed meeting, and I guess I'm wondering, like, where does the state go from here? I mean, is it just a matter of, so there was the quote-unquote no promo homo law, which was the subject of a lawsuit. The state ended up repealing that. These were some maybe additional changes, Roy, you mentioned trying to make education medically accurate. There's some other language that proponents were hoping to remove from state statute. Is it just going to be status quo for a while now until something changes?
Probably. I mean, it's hard to see. I mean, certainly the people that were opponents of the changes at this last meeting, they're going to be back. And no matter, I think, how much you tweak, you know, the additional guidelines. And so we're going to be down there again, probably dealing with this. Obviously, changes need to be made as a result of different things that have happened at the legislature and through the lawsuit. So they have to do something. I found the things to be reasonable, but clearly people disagreed. Maybe there's a compromise. But in these kinds of issues, it's very difficult to find one. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, especially there was a lot of misinformation going on in the opposition as well, as being pushed by Planned Parenthood, and they're introducing all these specific items into it. That wasn't what people were debating at all. That wasn't the facts on the table. So I think the other side perhaps should out-organize this time, and just to balance the voices a little bit. I think it's going to go through, but this will put major strains on school district offices when they have to make the decisions about specific language, because it's going to be different for different communities around the state.
John, does this tee us up for what could be a potentially exceedingly awkward conversation about sex ed next year at the legislature?
Oh, I want video of that. It could be entertaining.
It's all
to watch.
Archived.
Yeah, yeah. It will be entertaining to watch them fumble through it if it's anything like me trying to talk to my teenage daughters about anything whatsoever. I've let my saintly wife handle all that because I'm an idiot on these things. But yeah, it's true that standards just have to be updated. You have to update languages. You know, I grew up in Arizona and we had our talk in like fifth or sixth grade at school and all the little boys giggling and the girls in a separate room giggling. And, you know, it seemed like something out of the 1950s when we saw it. So they have to update it. It's something that our kids need.
All right, let's move on to a Supreme Court ruling dealing with the citizenship question. Basically, the question asking, are you a U.S. citizen? Pretty straightforward question. There had been a lot of concern that this question would lead to an undercount. And Roy, in Arizona, an undercount would have pretty substantial implications.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, undercount would potentially lose us an additional congressional seat, a 10th congressional seat, which we're due to get after the next census. And in our state, in any other state, it could potentially lose billions of dollars because you're undercounted. So, you know, it was a victory. It was, I think, perhaps a temporary victory because I think Trump is probably going to try to do this again.
And there are more lawsuits still sort of working their way through the system at this point.
Absolutely. And there's a real question of whether there's time, you know, from a practical perspective on the printing of the census and whether Trump could even come back in time for it. But certainly he asked. I mean, I saw the reaction from him asking his Department of Justice lawyers to delay the census, which is illegal, but I see Trump asking for a lot of illegal things sometimes, so I'm not surprised. But my point is, I guess, that it is a temporary win, and it's good for Arizona, for our representation, and for our federal dollars.
I wonder, so I've spoken with some people in the Latino community here in the Valley about sort of the fear that this question raised, the sort of memories that this brought up, and the, at one point someone told me, you know, it's just insulting to even have it on there. It's like wearing a Star of David. Like you have to identify yourself in this way that I am an immigrant or I am not an immigrant. Have you heard those sorts of things from the community, Roy, or like, is this something that you think, are people's fears allayed at this point?
Well, no. I mean, that community, our community, the Latino community, the fears are not allayed because there's other fears, right? But certainly on this issue, the fears were well-founded. I mean, you know, if you add this question to the census, clearly you're going to get people who don't want to answer the question. It's not just people that are here that are undocumented. It's also people here who are legal residents and don't know how to answer the question, and they're not going to answer it. And so not having it in there, I think, is a good thing. I think that's going to result in more people participating. But, of course, there's other issues going on with immigration and how, you know, ICE is enforcing immigration laws internally and at the border that people are dealing with in the community every day.
John, we talked about the tightrope that Senator McSally and, to an extent, Senator Sinema have to walk. I'm wondering about maybe the tightrope that Governor Ducey had to walk on this issue, because obviously he doesn't want to miss out on millions and millions and millions of federal dollars for the state to take care of things like roads and other infrastructure. I don't know if he cares that the state gets another congressional seat. He probably would like the state to have a little bit more clout in D.C. But at the same time, he sided with the Trump administration in saying that this question ought to be on the census.
Yeah, I think he bowed to political reality on that, but he knew it wasn't his decisions and the courts would make the final judgment. What the courts did is basically say including the question is okay in theory, but we don't trust this administration's motivations because they were pretty transparent about their motivations. And yeah, I don't think it will be a question on the census. I think they will run into print issues because there's just so much time to get ready for the census. So that's definitely good news for Arizona. And once again, it's a question that seems innocuous, but when you know the motivation behind it, you know that it's going to intimidate certain populations.
And it seems as though, based on some of those lower court cases that are still working their way through, that partisan nature is something that opponents of the question are really trying to get at. This Republican consultant who passed away within the last year, apparently they found all sorts of documents saying that if you include this question, you will decrease Latino turnout, which will be good for Republicans.
Yeah, yeah, which is as cynical as it can get, and it reminds any of us who were here during the Joe Arpaio days of just kind of the rampant Just discrimination day to day, trying to not count certain communities. I used to drive through the small community near Tempe of Guadalupe. daily to work, and every once in a while you'd see huge mobile command centers for the sheriff just harassing people on the street. And then when they saw me in my car, they just waved me through. So there's just this ugly undercurrent that we've very recently experienced in Arizona, and I think the vast majority of us, including Governor Ducey, does not want to go back to that.
Speaking of tightropes, right, like the message now that has to come out, if this question is not on the census, as I guess we can assume it will not be at this point unless something changes, which it could, if that is not on the census, what is the message to the Latino community here? How do you convince people that this is something that's worth doing and it's okay to do, especially considering, Roy, like you said, there are lots of other things that are playing into this?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of organizations out there that are in the community trying to, explain the issue, explain, you know, what the rules are, what the law is, how important participation in the census is. I think that will continue. That's crucial work. While this was a temporary victory and hopefully a permanent victory, those groups still have to go out there and inform the community that it's, you know, you're safe by filling this out, right? Just like you need to know your rights when people are knocking on your door. I mean, those are the kinds of things that need to be told to people, and I think that's what's happening.
We have a couple minutes left in the Friday Newscap, guys. I want to ask you about an Arizonan elevated to arguably the most high-profile position in the Trump administration that is not actually the president themselves. Stephanie Grisham is the new press secretary. Now, John, there's a sort of a tradition among press secretaries from successive administrations. They leave a flak jacket in the office, you know, sort of as a symbol of, you know, you're going to be taking a lot of fire, I guess, quote unquote, from the press. How many flak jackets do you think are hanging in Stephanie Grisham's office right now?
Oh, gosh, several, and some of them are already smoking probably. So, yeah, how anyone, good for her, mazel tov, have a wonderful time there. How anyone would want that position is kind of beyond me because, once again, just like we can check Twitter and it's like, oh, well, what did the president say today? The press secretary has to deal with that.
She's got to respond to it.
Oh, yeah. So she has her work cut out for her. Good luck.
Well, I mean, you know, she's following, in my view, one of the worst press secretaries we've ever had. And so the bar is pretty low. I mean, if we can start with just telling the truth to people, that's an improvement. You know, the last secretary got rid of the daily briefing, which is a tradition forever. And so I don't know if that's going to come back. I doubt it. But at the end of the day, it's a very difficult job because you don't know what Trump's going to do on a daily basis or a minute by minute basis. And so how do you represent somebody like that to the press?
And when he makes a decision, he changes the reason for the decision three times that day. So it's very difficult.
That's totally right. Now, I will say about Ms. Grisham is that obviously in her background here in Arizona, she represented some very mercurial figures here, political figures. Here, so perhaps she's got some experience in that arena now that she's going to be representing Trump.
That goes along the lines of my next question. Last question, probably have time for is based on her experience here and a lot of the stories that came out about what happened while she was representing some of those figures here in Arizona. What do you predict? Is she the right person for this job?
Probably is the right person for the job just because of that experience. I mean, there's not many people that have had that experience. Arizona, you know, has had a very interesting political history, and that, you know, some of that history that she's been involved in is very similar in a lot of ways to how Trump does things, right? And so maybe having that experience will help her. But again, you know, who knows with Trump, right? You can never predict what he's going to do.
It's kind of like the rule about New York. If you can survive in Arizona politics, you can make it anywhere. So.
I think Sinatra would have written a song about that had he still been around, right?
Yeah, right.
All right, that is John Gabriel, editor-in-chief of Ricochet.com. We've also been joined by former congressional staffer Roy Herrera on the Friday Newscap. Guys, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger here along with Mark Brody. As we just discussed yesterday, the Supreme Court put a controversial question about citizenship status on hold. The court ruled that at this time, the federal government cannot ask about citizenship status on the 2020 census. The ruling was 5-4 with Chief Justice John Roberts joining the liberal justices in the decision. Opponents to the citizenship question have argued it would have a chilling effect on people filling out the census. taxes, which in turn affects the amount of federal tax dollars and the number of legislative districts provided to each state. According to some estimates, Arizona could have been one of the hardest hit states on that level. Local civil rights leader Alejandro Chavez was a plaintiff in the case, and he's the grandson of legendary activist Cesar Chavez. I spoke with him about this earlier this morning and began by asking him about something he said the last time he came into our studios. The question, he said, scares the hell out of me, is the quote. So I asked him, is he relieved?
Yes, and we have a way to go. We've still got to get them printed. It's like until the check's cashed almost, right? So we've got to get them printed. We've got to get them mailed out. But if people still don't participate, we haven't actually completed what we're trying to do, which is get everyone counted. So it is a process that we're trying to do. And the first process is making sure everyone can be counted and will be counted. Mm-hmm. So that's the first hurdle. And yes, it's a huge win. And yes, it scares me a little less. But they're not printed yet. So, I kind of am still not ready to sit back yet.
Well, and the president also said yesterday he wants his lawyers to consider looking into delaying the census over this. So you're not sitting quite easy yet.
Right.
Okay. I want to talk about your concerns about this to remind everyone about why these lawsuits were in place, why this was such a controversial question to begin with. What were your major issues here?
Look, roads are a huge thing. I'll be honest, infrastructure. We've been growing so much. I mean, when I first moved here 11 years ago, I used to be able to get from where I live to here in, 20 minutes freeway time.
You live in West Phoenix.
I live in West Phoenix, correct. Now there's significantly more traffic. You can't crud across the 17 because everybody does it now. And if you try to go down to, Levine and cut across, now everybody does that too. So our population is just growing. Mm-hmm. And the roads need to be able to reflect that. It also is about how we're going to get funding to make sure we have enough police and enough firefighters and just enough resources for everybody, as well as schools. My son and my daughter are going to be going to the same school. Mm-hmm. As a parent, I'm excited. Two drop-offs and two pickups is a nightmare. But knowing that they're going to be getting the funding they need and making sure is even that much more important.
But you also talked about the real concerns and memories of segregation and of fear from the immigrant community that this question even being suggested brought up. Tell us a little bit about what you've been hearing from your community as this has been playing out.
Yeah. Let's also remember a lot of people are in mixed families and their children who are U.S. citizens are going to these schools. Aside from the fear mongering and aside from the being targeted, aside from the having their name in a database with an administration who, let's be honest, we really don't feel we can trust with that information. So people are feeling better about being able to give that information truthfully, but they also really are going to benefit from the schools and the infrastructure because they use those things as well. And that's why it was so important.
The last time you were here, you told me a question like this is the first way to send people back into the shadows.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if the threat of this and the conversation around this has already started to do that. Are you concerned that this is scaring people to the point that even if the question's not on there, they don't want the federal government to have their information?
Yeah, some damage like that is already done. That's why it's important to get them printed and start the process right away so we can start getting more opportunities to visit those communities. We can have them visited by people they trust in areas they trust so that we can break down that barrier. You know, one thing is when that trust is broken, it can be rebuilt. However, we have to start the process. And the only way we can start it is by having those census forms in our hands, out there, getting the people on the doors, talking, the people who are from the community. The community leaders that are going to be out there for this, they're going to be hosting forums in English and Spanish to help people understand why it's important to complete them, support mm-hmm. people through the process. We can't do that until we have those forums. So I think some of that damage is done. But even though the trust is broken, I think we can close the ground on that once we start the process.
So how do you go forward from here with this sort of up in the air? If printing does start on Monday, as it is supposed to, or if it is delayed, what's the message to the community? How do you convince them this is worth it for them?
It's funny. My grandfather, there's a story about my grandfather. A student was trying to do a report on him and trying to break down what he did. And so they followed him. They said, Cesar, so what do? You know, you organize millions of farm workers. What is it you do? And he says, well, first I go and I talk to one person. And then I go and I talk to another person. And I go and I talk to another person, and the person kind of laughs. Okay, I get it. You're an organizer. You talk to people. And he says, but really, like, what is it? You have to have a secret. I mean, everybody tries it. Mm-hmm. He says, I do. And he says, oh, what is the secret? He says, I go and I talk to one person, and I go and I talk to one person, and I go and I talk to one person. And basically, it's that this work needs to happen one person at a time. That's why it's so important that every block has three or four people, like myself, who are out there talking to their neighbors, as well as the people that the census hire. Someone talking to them and really sharing their personal narrative is going to make the difference. And I think that's how we go forward. One person at a time, talking to one more person, and making it happen.
All right. Alejandro Chavez, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Today is the final day of the Arizona-Mexico Commission's 60th Anniversary Summit. It's at a Valley Resort. Hundreds of attendees have been hearing from political and policy leaders from both sides of the border. Matthew Casey with our Fronteras desk spoke with one of the featured guest speakers, the former Mexican ambassador to the U.S. about U.S.-Mexico relations. Matt is here now. Good morning.
Hi, Mark.
So you interviewed the ambassador. He was the ambassador to the U.S. from 2017 to 18. He served at the end of the last Mexican president's term. What is his take on this new proposed free trade deal?
Jerónimo Gutiérrez was ambassador during negotiations for the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement, which is, of course, the reboot of NAFTA that Mexico recently approved, but we still have not. Gutiérrez says no country got everything it wanted with USMCA, which, of course, can be the sign of a good compromise.
Nobody's 100% happy, but I think it's agreement that works, and I think that's a good signal.
Now, the governors of Arizona and Sonora have made a joint push to get the new trade agreement through. Did he talk about how tensions over immigration might be impacting that?
Well, Gutiérrez told me that traditionally the two countries have kept trade and migration as separate issues, right? Siloed. But now they've become intertwined. I mean, President Trump threatened tariffs over migration. So Gutiérrez says Mexico's goal in recent talks with the U.S. has been to find a way to separate the issues again and keep it that way going forward. He told me that's key because there are big opportunities if USMCA gets approved.
And certainly out of the countries, it'll be the border states in particular that get a lot of the benefits of the agreement.
Now, Mexico has stepped up its efforts to stem the flow of immigrants along its southern border with Guatemala. Does the ambassador think his country is doing enough at this point?
Well, Gutiérrez was very clear throughout the day yesterday with everyone that he doesn't think Mexico or the U.S. have done a good job on immigration in recent decades, right? He says that working together going forward is key, and especially getting to the root of the problem of why people leave home and come north. He told me that he sees aspects of migration as public safety issues, like human trafficking, for instance, but he didn't want to call migration a national security issue. Our colleague Jorge Valencia reported yesterday that Mexico's National Migration Institute has 6,000 employees and there are about 100,000 migrants coming into Mexico each month. Gutiérrez says he favors putting resources into the Migration Institute and strengthening it. Right now, it currently implements immigration laws but doesn't have the power to enforce the law.
It's not good to have the military or the National Guard involved in immigration issues. I don't think it's a good idea. It's not now and not ever.
All right. So, Matt, today is the last day of the Arizona-Mexico Commission meetings. What's on tap?
There's a so-called fireside chat this morning with some of Arizona's congressional delegation. There's a few other panel discussions about emerging business opportunities. And then this afternoon, we have Governor Doug Ducey, his Sonoran counterpart, Governor Claudia Pavlovich, and Senator Martha McSally. They're all scheduled to take part in a forum on the future of North American trade.
All right. That is KJZZ's Matthew Casey. Matt, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Likewise, Mark. Have a good day.
As in many Mexican states, hundreds of Sonorans have gone missing in recent years. Official investigations don't turn up suspects or bodies, leaving family members to wonder and worry about their son, brother, or husband's fate. Some, however, have taken upon themselves to find those bodies and have recently had a fair amount of tragic success. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk in Hermosillo, Mexico, Murphy Woodhouse reports.
Early on a recent Saturday, a group of mostly women started gathering in front of the state attorney's office in downtown Hermosillo, Sonora's capital. Most were wearing white shirts bearing simple portraits, along with a date. The day that person, a brother, a father, a cousin, was last seen.
Mi nombre es Andrea Ramirez Lugo.
She's looking for her son.
Mi nombre es Nancy Rico.
And her son has been missing for nearly 3 years.
Jessica Janet Pula Santana.
Francisco, her brother, was last seen in Guaymas, Sonora.
Francisco Javier.
These are the Guerreras Buscadoras de Sonora, or Sonoran Warrior Searchers. It's a women-led group formed early last year that has undertaken the search for missing loved ones. Chapters have since spread across the state.
Es una hermandad esto que estamos haciendo.
That's Guadalupe Lopez, who traveled from the coastal city of Empalme to join the Hermosillo effort. Her husband went missing nearly a year ago. She says the group is a sisterhood bound together by pain like hers. From downtown Hermosillo, a caravan of cars headed southwest, out into the open desert. The destination was a nondescript, lonely stretch of highway flanked by barbed wire fences. The searchers flocked to a truck loaded down with shovels, picks, and stakes to gear up for the search. Before starting, they formed a large circle to pray. And then the search was on. That's group founder Maria Teresa Valdez, giving out instructions for the search. Her brother Fernando went missing in 2015. She's telling volunteers to form a line along the fence to comb the area. They're looking for places where the dirt has been disturbed, looks wet, or otherwise suspicious. They then drive their sharpened rebar stakes into the ground. Tips emerging with an ammonia odor may indicate a good place to dig. Shovel in hand, Baltasar Paraleal was on a rise scanning the desert. He had come down from Nogales, Sonora to look for his missing son of the same name.
Encontrarlo como esté, donde esté, y pues nada más.
Expressing a sentiment shared by many searchers, he says he and his family just want to know where his son is, not what happened or who's responsible.
Sí, porque su mamá no descansa. Ni yo tampoco.
Not knowing has meant many restless nights for him and his wife. Half an hour later, Para, Valadez, and others were digging up a spot she found promising.
No, aquí esto no tiene mucho, esto está reciente, esto está removida reciente.
The ground here had been turned up recently, she says, but ultimately, none of the other telltale signs of a body were found. While that Saturday's search turned up no remains, the Guerreras have had a great deal of macabre success in recent months. This spring, on the outskirts of Ciudad Obregón in southern Sonora, they dug up 38 bodies in an area known as Campo 30, or Field 30. Tips about where to look often come anonymously to group members, who don't ask for details. State officials assist during searches as well as identify the remains and return them to family members. There are roughly 2,200 missing people in Sonora. In January, the former head of the National Searching Commission said there were more than 40,000 nationwide. But the work of the Guerreras can help push that figure down. In May, two of the bodies among the 38 were identified as brothers Andres Benito and Daniel Herrera. Nogales, Arizona resident Ana Cristi Herrera is their sister.
Es una angustia y un dolor. Que en realidad no hay palabras.
It's anguish, a pain there just aren't words for, she says. You go to bed worrying about them. Are they hurting? Are they hungry? Water gets stuck in your throat thinking that they may be thirsty, wherever they are.
Es el fin de estar con ese dolor.
Having their bodies returned was the end of the pain of not knowing where they are, she says. But it was also the start of mourning the fact that they're never coming back. Murphy Woodhouse, KJZZ News, Hermosillo, Mexico.
Okay, Mark, so now it is time for the next edition of Sonoran Arcana. So this is our series that seeks to define Arizona food with Phoenix New Times food critic Chris Malloy.
So what yummy food did you get to have this month, Lauren?
Such attitude there. You're jealous.
I am. Of course I'm jealous.
All right, so this time it is all about native Arizona crops. We went to classic Valley restaurant Phoenix City Grill to try them out. All right, Chris, it is the June edition of Sonoran Arcana. Middle of summer, but where are we in this nice, cool dining room?
We are at Phoenix City Grill, and we are about to get into the Ramona Farm Superfood Salad, which is one of the many great offerings at this old school classic that highlights some of the amazing bounty of our state.
Okay, and you did this long feature on Ramona Farms, and tell us a little bit first about the history here. When I think of them, I think about tempura beans.
Yeah, so Ramona Farms was founded in 1974 by Ramona and Terry Button. It's on the Gila River Indian Reservation, down southeast of the city. And they started with 10 acres. Over the years, they built up to 4,000 acres. And on a fraction of that acreage, they grow some indigenous crops, including the tepary bean. Now, the tepary bean is a desert-adapted bean that is native to this area and that almost went extinct over the decades. But Ramona and Terry, shortly after Ramona's father passed, they found a jar of old tepary's in a trunk that belonged to her father, and they started planting them because her father was all about experimenting with plants and animals. And so they kind of wanted to honor him by planting those beans as they started their farm. And by the end of the 70s, they were starting to grow some serious quantities of tepary beans and selling them around the reservation and even beyond. And now they're one of the amazing local crops that we have here.
And there's an environmental aspect to this too, right? Like this is a desert-adapted crop.
Yeah, so the tepary is unique in that if you plant it to align with the monsoon season and the summer rains, it can survive on only one rainfall. It requires almost no rain. And if you look at it out in the fields, like the soil will be all parched and cracked, but the bean will be thriving. It almost loves those conditions. And it has this real rich flavor and a kind of smooth density. You can use it for a lot of different things. As the Southwest gets hotter and drier and the world kind of warms up, as climate change ramps up, crops like this could become more and more important. I mean, it doesn't require a whole lot of water. It's hardy. It can fight through a lot, and it tastes great, and it's really nutritious.
All right, and we're also here with the chef here at Phoenix City Grill, Michael Weislick. So I want to ask you, chef, how you learned about this farm. Why have a whole dish on your menu dedicated to it?
Well, Phoenix City Grill's been here about 22 years, and we're constantly looking for indigenous ingredients, local farmers supporting as well as we can. And so it started by us looking specifically for a garbanzo bean and the tepary bean, and we did some research and reached out and contacted Terry, and they said, oh yeah, give us a few days and we're out in the field right now, we'll mail you a sample. Well, that night they showed up in their truck with a truck full of samples, and that's basically the story. And so we've been a partner and supported them, you know, since then.
That's really cool. Okay, well let's try it.
Good, a lot going on.
Tell us about what flavors do you get, Chris?
They have like a, it's hard to explain. There's like an earthiness, like a robust earthiness to it that you don't get with beans. It's like, it's kind of like rustic and refined at the same time. It's very enjoyable and it reminds you of the land.
What about you? How do you use them? How do you like to use tepary's?
Well, you know, like in this salad, we slow poach them, if you will. So they get a nice undertone of flavor. And then we just use them in the salad just like that. We've used them very similar to like a hummus, like a white bean puree or a spread. In the summertime when we can get fresh sweet corn, we try and pair it with what we call the three sisters, so the corn, the tepary beans, and a local squash. We've also done a puree with it and done like similar to a Mexican street corn and use the beans as a puree as a base. So we've used it in several different ways.
But that's not even the only ingredient, like you mentioned, from Ramona Farms in the salad. And Chris, you read about some of the other things that they work on growing there. It's not just tepary beans. There are other sort of heritage products they're working on cultivating.
Yeah, so there's four different kinds of corn, four different colors of corn, too, which is really cool. What Ramona Farms does is they roast the corn out in the fields where they pick them by hand. They hand-pick the corn, which is pretty incredible. And then they process that corn into this amazing library of different products. I mean, all kinds of grits and polentas and indigenous gavisa is one of them. Pinole, yeah.
So you write here that you think that what they're doing on this farm has the capacity to change how we eat here in Metro Phoenix. And I wonder why you think that.
For a few different reasons. Arizona is a really rich agricultural state. And people don't realize that from outside the state, but we can grow a wide variety of things here, and a lot of them come from afar. But I think growing a lot of these crops that are really well suited to the desert is ecologically sound for the long term, but also like you are kind of representing the desert in a beautiful way by growing these desert adapted crops like the tepary beans, the Hopi corn. I think there's that element where you're kind of getting this next level connectedness with your environment. But then also, these are crops that have the character of our land, and it kind of comes through in the flavors. Like you get that kind of, with the tepary bean, I said, that kind of like rustic, rugged earthiness that is almost mirrored to what the Sonoran is like. It has this kind of rustic, rugged character to it, but it's also beautiful. And I think that these foods really reflect that in an interesting way that's a little bit hard to describe. But when you have it, it becomes clear to you. They have a lot of character.
Do you agree with that, Micah? Like, do you think when you use products like this, or when you're trying to support a local farm like this, you can really sort of change the food culture of this place?
Without a doubt. I think what Ramona Farms does is there's a high level of passion involved in this. You know, I mean, the hours that they put in the fields, I mean, if you knew the work ethics involved and the love that comes into it, and then bringing it into our kitchens, you can taste, like you said, you can taste the heritage, you can taste the earthiness, the love. It's really important for people like Ramona and what they do at their farm to continue this process.
So you do say, though, only a handful or so of Phoenix chefs are really using these products and doing this. Do you think that we're at a tipping point, though? Like, you're pursuing in this column this idea, like, what is Arizona food? What is Sonoran food today? Do you think it's shifting?
I hope so. I mean, these are beautiful ingredients, and you can find them on some menus here, but they're not all over the place. Like, I think as people recognize the just amazingness of the environment we live in, and some of the chefs that are getting recognition today, they're using Arizonan ingredients, they're using Sonoran ingredients, they are really tapped into farms like Ramona Farms, and I think Ramona Farms and places like it could be the catapult that, you know, we need here to really be seen as a nationally great food city.
Chris, Micah, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Lauren.
My pleasure, thank you.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.